suppose the problem for humanity is there's a lot of people in here right now, and everyone thinks that they're the special one, even though all the evidence points towards the fact that it's me. I don't know why we need to feel so special as human beings. We grasp for anything that will make us feel special. I was dumped many years ago by somebody who went on to write an album. I listened to the album thinking, I imagine a couple of these songs would be about me. None of them. The worst moment for me was seeing a picture of him online being hugged by somebody who had also rejected me. I was sat there alone thinking, I don't think there's any way that one of them saying, how's Simon? The therapist that I saw for 2 years saw that I needed to be so special because I was terrified of intimacy. In our first session, I was being quite funny, and she said, so wisely, it's really good that you could be funny, but you know you don't have to be funny here. And I got what she was saying, I carried on talking, and then she said, you know you don't have to be interesting. And then I was really confused and said, do you want me to tell these stories, but not as well? And what she wanted was for me to be authentic and grounded, but I found that very difficult because I'm so funny and interesting. What I had to learn eventually was it doesn't really matter how funny or interesting you think you can be. You still can't get everyone to love you. My dad, for example, didn't come to the last couple of stand-up tours that I did, and when I asked him why, he said, well, I don't think you need my validation anymore, do you? And then he said that it wasn't his sort of thing. And I wasn't brave enough to ask, what, comedy or me? For fear that he would say, oh no, I love comedy. I realized in the end that my problem with my father is not my father, it's my expectation of him as a father. I thought, let's stop thinking of him as that and just start thinking of him as a man who ejaculated. Because often when men have ejaculated, they're tired. You can't expect them to go on and love you. I can't just keep screaming in my head for the rest of my life, if you can't love a child, don't ejaculate in a person. Do it out the window. If I'm to focus on anything, it should be on how grateful I am to my mum for birthing me out of her body. How can I ever thank her for that? The best I can do is occasionally introduce her to a celebrity, but is that enough? Thank you for your womb. Here's James Corden. Not that my mum is perfect. I had a memory of her screaming at my siblings and I one morning, one day you'll come home from school and I'll be gone. I reminded her of this and she didn't remember, but she said, look, I was a single parent. I said, that's worse, one had already gone. In a moment of openness on the phone recently with my mum, she told me that when she was pregnant with me, my dad wasn't being that great and a friend of hers called Mark took her out one day and he was so sweet and kind. She thought about leaving my father and raising me with Mark instead. She said, of course, I didn't do that. But that's why your middle name is Mark. It's very important not to talk to your parents. But what are these problems? Are these problems? I saw another therapist a while ago and I was saying, compared to other people, what is any of this? And he said, all feelings are valid. He said, if you lost a leg and the person next door lost two legs, you would still have lost a leg. And I thought, what is going on this street? I think there have been problems. I had a mild eating disorder a few years ago. I don't know if it's an eating disorder. I've never deliberately thrown up food, but I have tried a bit too hard to poo. Now, is it an eating disorder if once to try and get something going, you poked a finger in? Is that? It's not what you call classic bulimia, but it's something. I don't know if that bit was worth the truth. I don't know. So I hadn't seen my dad for a while, and then I met up with him, and his big news was he had trained to become a hypnotherapist, which really angered me, because I thought, you can't be the therapist, you're the trauma. He then said that what would be great is if I could introduce him to some of my crazy friends so he could be a hypnotherapist to the stars. I kept it all inside because I thought, why express how I'm feeling to you now when I could save it all up for a show that won't be your sort of thing? However, through this hypnotherapy training, he developed a kind of emotional language that I hadn't witnessed in him before, and we started talking about his very cold, distant mother. And as he told me about her, I thought, oh my God, you are the more vulnerable one. You had the worst childhood. I have to find some way to love you. How did you turn it around, you sneaky little hypnotist? I think maybe because of all that stuff, I found it very difficult, or at least it took me a long time to become comfortable with the idea of being loved. I just wasn't used to intimacy, I suppose, and then when my boyfriend told me that he loved me, it was a bit like what happened when my brother cleaned his hamster's cage. He'd never done that before, and then when he cleaned the cage, the hamster died of shock. Near the beginning of the relationship, we were in France together, and it's really the most beautiful, authentic relationship I've ever been in. And there were croissants. And I think it's so good because there's this real honesty between us. We will talk about people who we find attractive. That's so different to relationships I've been in the past, where there was so much jealousy. I was with someone for a while who was so jealous, I found myself having to say, I really don't find anyone attractive. And it's weird because before I met you, but they must have all moved. In this relationship, we'll talk about people we find attractive. We used to be a bit more sneaky about it. Like, we'd go to see some ballet and we'd talk about the magic of the movements. But we knew that what we were saying was, it'd be nice to take one home and lick him. And we should be able to do that because the tickets are so expensive. So we were in France together, and despite this being a near perfect relationship, or maybe because it's so perfect, I fall asleep next to him and I have a dream that I'm in a sex dungeon being seduced by, I don't even know how to describe him other than wet slut, I don't know. And it wasn't water, it was lubricant. He was just covered. He was covered in lubricant. I should have known it was a dream, but my dreams are not always this exciting. The other night I had a dream that I was in a queue. And before I got to the end of the queue, I woke up. So I said to this guy in the dungeon, it's lovely that you brought me here, but I'm in a relationship, I can't really get involved. And then I couldn't stop him, I think because he was so slippery. And we did all kinds of sordid, wonderful things together, but then I thought, oh my God, what have I done? I've betrayed the best relationship I've ever been in. What am I going to do? I've ruined my life. And then I woke up. I was in France. Everything was fine. Everything was fine. But then for the next 3 days, all I could think was, I really love that sex dungeon. And is that who I really am? Because you can't argue with the unconscious. Everything now just seems so appropriate and polite in real life. Do you want another croissant, Simon? No! I want to shove this pan au chocolat up your ass! Your body's so dry. Couldn't stop thinking that I was just this animal who wanted to be in a dungeon and everything else is just a bit of conventional behavior. And then I attended my boyfriend's mother's birthday dinner where his brother gave this beautiful, heartfelt speech about how much he loves his parents and how he really appreciates how accepting they've been of all their children, no matter who they turned out to be. And I start crying, feeling so safe and accepted here, and I turn to my boyfriend and I say, This is better than a sex dungeon. The family found it very sweet too. And then a couple of years into the relationship, I met this very beautiful man who seemed very interested in something happening between us that night. And it was too much, but I walked away because my relationship is my priority. And it was, you know, I felt good. I was able to walk away, but I couldn't stop thinking about what a shame it was to not been able to go with this moment. And I felt really disgusting even thinking about it. And then I didn't want to bring it up with my boyfriend, but I eventually did. And he looked very serious and then said, "Well, I'm really glad you've told me about that. I guess what you're saying is you're a human being." I said, "Oh, right, yeah. But I couldn't have slept with him, right?" "No." He said, "No, but I agree. It is a shame." So we thought about it for a few days, we discussed it, and we came to the conclusion that we didn't really want to be in an open relationship, but if somebody insanely beautiful just presented themselves to you, maybe it would be silly not to go with it. So the rule is, we don't sleep with people outside the relationship, but we could, in principle, if it was unmissable and required no effort. And because of that kind of communication, last year, we were able to attend a sex party. Thank you. It would not have been possible for me before to go to a sex party. I would have thought, with my personality, what I bring to a social setting is humor, and nobody wants an ironic blowjob. How was the orgy? Oh, so witty, so witty. But on this occasion, we both thought, oh, we're all going to die, we must go to the sex party. So that's a phrase, isn't it? I think that's a phrase. So we were both a bit nervous, but we put it in our diaries, and then... And then 1 week before that sex party, we were at a club night where one of the floors suddenly just turned into a sex party. And it was a week too soon. We'd eaten pasta. And we hadn't discussed how involved we were going to get, so we thought we'll just stay together and do some very cautious touching of other bodies. I touched a bottom that was so hard, it was like a cupboard. And it was fun, but as someone who's often said things like, "We're all just animals, why aren't we all naked and having sex all the time?" Once everyone was naked and having sex, I really want to see somebody in a hat. Having thought for many years, why aren't we an orgy? This should be an orgy. I want to be an orgy. At the end of that night, I thought, oh God, next week we've got another orgy. But I feel so relieved, really, more than grateful, that I'm in this relationship where we can talk to each other. We get to invent our lives together rather than, I don't know, just sort of following what other people think we should be doing. I occasionally feel really threatened by normality. I was at quite a traditional wedding recently and had a very strong feeling that if the Nazis came to take me away, the people at the wedding would feel sad, but not stop them. I felt quite angry all day. I think partly I just can't believe people are still getting married. People with degrees, what's going on? They've already lived together for 10 years, now they have to announce they're going to carry on as they are. Why do I have to go to Dorset for that? Have to announce you're so happy. If you're so happy, stay in your house and shush. Just send an email saying it's going very well, carry on. What would be wrong with this conversation? "I love you. I love you too. Should we have a big event where we tell everyone we know?" It seems arrogant. It's so smug. You wouldn't get everyone you know together to say, "We've made so much money, we think it will last until death." With a bit at the end where you'd toss a bouquet of spare cash at the poor people. Don't like normality. I felt really good visiting a school recently that teaches children who are autistic. And I ended up saying to the head teacher, I don't really know anything, but it feels like the child who is autistic doesn't have autism. What they have is a kind of freedom from all the nonsense that we have to accept as normal. And if there's any stress or anxiety that they feel, isn't that often from us trying to make them the same as everyone else? And she said, well, that's a nice idea. But sometimes they want to masturbate in public. I nodded, but I thought, so? Like, would it be so bad? Like, isn't it worse for the parent in that moment to shame the child and feel ashamed and everyone's so ashamed? Better in that moment for the parent to say, people of the supermarket, gather. I felt so conventional at this school. I went to shake this kid's hand, and as I was shaking his hand, I could see him thinking, this is bullshit, isn't it? It was interesting to see what had to be taught. I was in a class of kids being taught to spread jam on toast. It's not that they can't do that. You can just see them thinking, why? What? This is just wasting valuable masturbation time. I think the world doesn't make enough sense for everyone to be expected to fit into it. In this country, we have a royal family. And not just in the past, now. People are very interested in them. To me, the only thing that's really interesting about them is they don't seem to be embarrassed. They walk into rooms, there are trumpets. If that was me, at some point, I would have to say, please, you mustn't, it's ridiculous. I'm just you, I'm basically you, but that's not what they do. They stand there and they must be thinking, yes, this is appropriate. I was born. I worry for them sometimes. There must be so much denial in their lives. Imagine every morning you wake up, you do a shit, and then for the rest of the day, you have to pretend that it didn't happen. Because if you're just a person who does a shit, the trumpets are going to start to sound sarcastic. Because no one is special. It doesn't matter what you do or even what you achieve. The ending is the same. You win the Olympics, you die. You get your dream home, you die. You're pregnant, oh, you both die. No one is special. Certainly not in a major city like London. Like, it's not even that exciting to you people that I'm here. And I'm very famous. People in the middle of England would lose their minds. We're all basically the same thing, and yet everything is about status. On every chat show on TV, it's welcome to the show, here's another famous person who's done another amazing thing, and it's unsettling for all of us. Really, it should be welcome to the show. As you know, life is suffering, and the self is an illusion. Please welcome my next guest, whose face is a mask covering an unknowable void. Nobody feels happy where they are. I decided a few years ago that it was very important that I go to America and start being funny there. And only because I thought it would be a bit embarrassing if I don't. Like, who am I if I don't go to America? Some regional comedian who's a bit famous on one tiny island, and if I go anywhere else, I'm you. So I went to New York City and I did these shows. It went really well. It should have been pure joy. Everything in my head became about what can I achieve? Where will I get to? And finally, somebody said to me, Simon, you're doing these shows in New York. Everyone's coming to see you. They're laughing. If you're not happy now, you'll never be happy. And I thought, oh, I'll never be happy. It's not like you even get what you used to get in show business, which was this feeling of elevation, of definitely being special. Before one of those shows in New York, somebody sent me a message over Twitter which said, can you let us know what time the show finishes? We have to book a babysitter. I'm the star! You can't just talk to me. I felt completely lost in LA. But then I met this guru who, it turned out he wasn't really a guru, but he had very good posture. And I was very drawn to his charisma, and I thought, he seems at peace. Maybe if I can listen to him, if I listen to everything he says, I'll have peace in my life, finally. And we were talking about meditation one day. I said I'd begun to enjoy meditation. Just feels like something I'm doing now every day, not like a duty, you know? And he said, well, do you know what that is? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you've gone from discipline to blissipline. I thought I was going to be happy. I went to see this dance piece. Don't go and see something if it's a piece. If somebody says to you, would you like to come and see my piece? You have to say, oh, I'm so sorry, I've hurt one of my fingers. I'd love to see the piece. Maybe let me know when it's the whole thing. It was this solo dancer. I'm gonna go down again. Rolling around on a floor. And then at one point she pulled a giant sheet of paper over her head. I guess to give the feeling, where is she? And then as the music climaxed, her foot burst through the paper and nobody laughed. I think the problem is we don't die quick enough. Somebody said to me the other day, you know, in 40 years you'll be 79. And I thought, how long is this going to go on for? We just keep living, so you have to keep coming up with things to do. And that's why you're here, so you've done something tonight. Because tomorrow people say, what did you do last night? You can say, I went to this comedy show, because I live in London, I'm alive. Are you, though? Or are you just desperately filling the time so you don't have to feel any pain? Well, you came to the wrong show. It's not that I'm even depressed anymore. I just don't know what this is. It used to be that I almost couldn't get out of bed in the morning. Now, I get out of bed, but I don't know why I've done it. I'm so annoyed I still have to earn money. I don't know how you feel. I feel like we were children playing, and then suddenly this economic system where nothing is ever enough, causing endless anxiety, destroying the planet. I said to my agent, is there any way out of this? Could I be a not-for-profit comedian? And she said, you're getting there. And so, feeling completely lost, desperate to figure out who I'm supposed to be in this world, I ended up in a sweat lodge. A sweat lodge, if you don't know, is a Native American ritual for resolving inner or outer conflict in a hot, womb-like teepee in Norfolk. There were two sweat lodge ceremonies. In the first one, I was just a bit too embarrassed to get involved because it was so powerful and sincere. People were forgiving their parents and honoring them. It was too much. But in the second ceremony, I thought, come on, You know, life is very short as well as much too long. Be in the teepee, and a conflict of gender equality arose. The shaman had explained that women who were on their moon period, which is what the shaman called a period, were not allowed in the teepee at that time. This caused a bit of tension, in part because one of the women who was on her moon period snuck in. And the shaman, I guess from his decades of training, knew. And as a response, this shaman suddenly took on this sexist character, kind of like a trickster, misogynist guy, to further inflame the tension. And some of the women, in the heat, in the madness of it all, started crying. The men looked deeply troubled, like they didn't know what to do. And then my whole body started vibrating, and I thought, maybe I alone hold the power to end misogyny. Because the truth is, how can there be any sexism? We all come from a woman. When do we begin to be sexist? Are we there in the womb thinking, well, this is all very well, but I think my dad would do a better job. Imagine emerging from this life-giving, warm, nurturing place and then going, okay, thank you, set fire to that now. How can the worst thing you can call someone be cunt? This is where we all emerge from. To say to someone you're a cunt is to say you're the doorway to life. It's like calling somebody an arsehole. If we didn't have arseholes, we'd explode. To say to someone you're an arsehole is to say you're a vital member of this community. Maybe some of the misogyny comes from the fact that we were ejected from the womb. We weren't allowed to stay there. And then maybe we were breastfed, but then that had to be stopped as well. We definitely miss our mother's breast milk. Of course we do. Of course we do. Otherwise, why would we have started stealing milk from other species? The cows must be thinking, this is nothing to do with you. This is for my child. It's not for your Cocoa Pops. Maybe this is an issue with your mother? Imagine if calves started attaching themselves to human women. And then complaining of lactose intolerance. And women, you control the continuation of human existence. Until there is equality, you could stop breeding. Maybe it's not for me to tell you what to do with your bodies, but I suppose have a baby if you really want to have a baby. But if it's a boy, you must abort. Yes. Yes, because it's a war. If you're a woman having sex with a man and creating more men, you should be hung for treason. Do you think Winston Churchill would have got pregnant if there was a 50-50 chance he could be a Nazi? And so in the intense heat of that teepee, my soul transcended any embarrassment and I found myself saying, I would like to honour my mother for doing her best under very difficult circumstances. And then I found myself saying that I would also like to honour my child self for doing the same. Something shifted. I felt strong, ready to be reborn, but I wanted to do something to protect this child self before he was thrust into the patriarchal madness of suburban Essex. So I started covering myself in mud. Nobody else was doing this. And I crawled out of that teepee. I fell down onto the grass. I burst into tears, in part for everything that lost child had gone through, and in part because I knew that misogyny had ended forever. I think I also realized in that teepee that one of the major reasons I found intimacy so difficult is I had to pretend to be another person for about 8 years. I never wanted to talk about this like it was a big deal, but I think that maybe is dishonoring the 13-year-old who had to cope with liking boys and not being able to tell anyone. I was so terrified at 13 that I might like boys. I remember thinking that it was probably the fear of liking boys that was causing me to like boys. This made sense to me at the time, even though I know people who are scared of heights don't also have an intense sexual urge to sit on a roof. Where are you going? How funny do I have to be, Daddy? I didn't know what to do. I couldn't talk to anyone. So I decided at the age of 18, I would go to Paris on my own in secret to figure out if I really did like boys or if it was just this fear in my head. So, and I remember packing, I got on the train and I packed a small black t-shirt, contact lenses and hair gel. That was it. Because I thought, how will these French people resist? A skinny boy with spiky hair and the suggestion of eyesight. As soon as I arrived in Paris, I freaked out slightly that nobody knew I was there. I thought, oh my God, I could just die here and nobody will get why. They'll say, all he had in him was hair gel. What was his plan? I was so nervous walking into this nightclub. I'd never been to a nightclub before. And what I thought would happen, this is quite naive maybe, but I thought that I was this new guy in town. Somebody, at least one person, would approach me and tell me who I am. Nobody did that, no one. And that's still so weird to me because when I think about that lost, shy, vulnerable, anxious young man, I think, that's my type. I wish I'd been there for me. In therapy, we discussed why I was often drawn to younger men, and it turned out I was trying to save the 18-year-old in me who wasn't saved. You may prefer to think of me as a pervert, but I'm actually a narcissist. And a pervert. So I eventually just got drunk enough so that I could go up to this very cute guy and say the French for, will you kiss me? And he just shrugged and kissed me. It was so amazing. I still remember thinking, as he was kissing me, oh yeah, gay. It was amazing. It ended much too quickly though. He had to leave. I didn't have the French for, I'm only here for one night, please stay. I can't believe that my French wasn't better when 2 years earlier, I'd received an A star for my GCSE oral exam for brilliant sentences like mon père travaille dans le banque. My dad didn't work in a bank, but I didn't know how to say he runs a cab company. And I thought, who's gonna check? So I thought, well, maybe I know who I am now. I could just go home. But I thought, I've come all this way. It's a long way to come. It's a shame not to touch a penis. So I imagine that's how a lot of people feel when they come to East London. So half an hour later, I see this other guy, very attractive. I go up to him. He speaks English, which means that I can say, can we go somewhere? And he says, sure. Then he takes me out of the club. We get our coats. We leave the club. And he takes me to a canal where I lose quite a bit of my virginity. And this may be the most romantic and disgusting sentence I have for you this evening. We then washed the cum off our hands in the fountains of Paris. So I'd confirmed what was obvious, and then all I had to do was spend the next few years trying to make my family feel comfortable. And that's an exhausting task, especially when all I could think was, how can there still be any homophobia when Elton John wrote The Lion King? What does he have to do? And the problem with needing people to love you, despite who you are, is you end up subtly compromising for them. You don't even realize it, but you agree somewhere to feel a bit uncomfortable about this bit of yourself as well, just enough to keep them in your life. And then, of course, any attempt at intimacy is going to be thwarted by this inability to just be yourself completely. I tried so hard with my dad, and it was very tricky because he'd found religion after my parents' divorce. For a long time, he was just canoeing, but then he found... We wouldn't have had the problems that we've had if he'd just committed to the canoeing or drowned, but... But he found this religion, and so I had to phone him, and I remember one day phoning him, so frustrated, I said, tell me the sentence in the Torah that's the problem, and we can discuss it. He didn't want to discuss it, so I said, well, I've got it in front of me, and one of the things it says is I should be put to death. And he said, well, that's not my responsibility. So not, let's disregard that sentence, Simon. Of course, it was written a long time ago by fallible human beings. Yes, that is what should happen, but I'm very busy. I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm running a cab company and a French bank. I found for my father in the book of Samuel, and Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David. They kissed each other and wept together until David became great. Unfortunately, at that point, the Bible pans to a shot of a fireplace, but... Nothing worked. And then more recently, my mum called me very angry because my dad hadn't invited my boyfriend and I to his daughter's, my half-sister's, bat mitzvah. And we hadn't been invited because in the Jewish religion, I don't know if you know, but if you are a boy and you have a boyfriend, it's very important that he's a girl. And I guess I would have felt angry in the past, but on the phone that day with my mum, I ended up saying, you know, he's not a monster. He just has a religion so he can cope with being alive. And as I said that, I realized I'd really let go of any need for my father's validation, acceptance, even attention. I thought, wow, the rage is gone. It's really finally gone. And then the next day, he invited us, and I was furious. So much therapy to accept that he wouldn't change. And he changed. I can't get the money back. So I called him after a few days and said, thank you for the invitation. What happened? And he said, nothing. I said, come on, something happened. And he said, let's imagine that you're in St. John's Wood. And you wanted me to come and pick you up and drive you to Edgware. And on the drive, you fell asleep. But then when you woke up, you were exactly where you wanted to be. Would it matter how we got there? What kind of cab company are you running? Almost made sense for a second until I realized that I hadn't been asleep for 15 years, and because I was terrified I wouldn't be able to stop screaming at him if I started, I just found myself saying, you know, feelings have been felt. And then he, I think because he couldn't say I'm sorry, said, I understand. And then said, but it has been very good material for you, which was difficult to argue with. You think it'd be so funny if you'd been raised by Mark? So we went to the bat mitzvah, and one of the first people I saw when I walked in was this friend of his who I hadn't seen for 15 years since she tried to convince me to become more religious. And when I told her 15 years ago that it wasn't for me, she said, are you happy? And I wasn't happy, and I thought, oh, she's got me. That's how they get you, these people. It's very important not to be unhappy, or you could end up in a cult. She said, it's been a long time, are you married? And I said, oh no, I've been with this guy for 6 years. And she looked nervous, which I found enjoyable. But rather than make her feel any more awkward, I kind of filled the space for her. I told her some stuff about him. And I suppose because I was happy, I was able to meet her fear with love. And then a rabbi came over and I thought, oh God, I don't know how many of these I can do. He also asked if I was married. I pointed to my boyfriend and he didn't know what to say. So he hugged me. And I went from feeling alarmed to patronized to realizing he wasn't hugging me. I was hugging a child who had just heard something that had scared him. And knowing, I guess instinctively, that he needed to be taken care of in that moment, I lifted up my shirt and let him suckle on my right nipple. And then he was fine. There's a real calm now to my relationship with my father. It just got very calm once we stopped trying to fix each other. And I realized in the end that the past couldn't have been any different. If he'd have been a different person at any point, I'd be a different person now. So to wish for the past to be different is just another form of self-hate. Some of this show is just wise. I suppose the fundamental reason why I needed to be so special is because it made me feel safe. And I didn't realize how unsafe I'd been feeling until I went to Peru and drank this healing plant medicine with a group of people and a shaman. It had the most profound, lasting effect on me. In one of the ceremonies, I was sat in this circle in the dark, I drank this brew, and I had a vision of myself in a pram being rocked by my mother, and I felt safe, I felt loved. And then the rocking stopped, and my mum wasn't there anymore. And then I had a vision of my mum in another room crying because she'd just been slapped around the face. And this whole baby's body tensed, my stomach tensed, my shoulders rounded, and I desperately wanted to do something to stop this man from hurting my mum. And then suddenly, something in the rainforest through this medicine said, you were just a baby. You couldn't even crawl. I just kept hearing that over and over again. You were just a baby. You couldn't even crawl. And finally, I was able to forgive this baby self. All this guilt and shame was lifted. I could see that I'd found shyness and then funniness as ways to feel safe. And all this depression was gone. The depression was just gone. And I spent the rest of the ceremony just dancing about. And I decided in that moment I never needed to be funny again. And I never was. I felt healed in that rainforest. I felt held by nature. I felt like I wasn't separate from it. I came out of there thinking, I am nature. And if we want to avoid our own extinction, we really need to be in communication with the planet that we're sitting on. When I arrived home, I was walking through Hampstead Heath, and I happened to say, it was like quite a nice day, and I was feeling quite happy, and I said, it'd be really great if there were some monkeys here. And just as I said that, a big rabbit hopped by. It was like God or nature said, we don't have monkeys here. Will this do? And the final piece of the healing came very recently when my boyfriend and I went to a party together and tried for the first time something called MDMA. Oh my God. What kind of a country do we live in where it's legal to buy alcohol and cigarettes, but they won't let us be happy? We were sat at this party on these big cushions. Oh, they were such good cushions. We were there with these very beautiful friends of ours, this guy called Harry, who's an artist that we both fancy, and Stephen, who is an actor who's, I've known him for many years, and I thought I was over any attraction to him recently, and then in front of me, he took a hat off, and his hair was still miraculous. And I thought, my God, if I put a hat on right now and then took it off, I'd have to go home. I'm so done with beauty. Beauty is too powerful. Sometimes I see somebody beautiful now, and I just feel tired. See how great. Now I've got to think about you for 20 years. It was nice to see Stephen at this party, but I always feel this great regret that we should have kissed years ago. There was a moment where we could have, but I wasn't able to receive the moment because I was too full of self-loathing. We were inhaling nitrous oxide from balloons. And I fell back on this bed, and he fell into my arm, and he said the words, whilst in my arm, "This is the most erotic moment of my life." And rather than kissing him, I thought, he must have just said the wrong word. He probably means erratic. Or is he asthmatic? But at this party, staring into Harry's eyes for maybe half an hour, pulling on his earlobe for a while, at some point he said, "Do you want me to kiss you?" And I said, "Yes, but I think it'd be good if you kissed my boyfriend as well." And he said, "Okay." So I said, "Quick!" Harry will kiss us now. So we all started kissing at this party, and then the only person on this joy-filled occasion who had taken cocaine came over. She looked quite judgmental, wanted to take Harry away. I thought, "You're at the wrong party, Cokey." She did take Harry away, and it was sad, but I thought, wow, all the conventions, all the boundaries are dissolving, all the boundaries of my own personality, of society, all gone. I thought there were no boundaries anymore. There were no boundaries. I looked at Stephen, who'd been there the whole time, and I said to no one in particular, "I think I'm just going to hold Stephen's hand for a while." And Stephen pulled his hand away, and I thought, there are boundaries. But it actually didn't feel like much of a rejection in that moment. It just felt like something that didn't happen. And I thought, I'll just hold my own hand. Which for a narcissist is a real treat. The whole night was so healing. And when I think about the things that have healed me in my life, they've often been illegal. Like, I had psychotherapy for 2 years, and that was great, but it was going to Peru and drinking ayahuasca that got to the root of the depression. And magic mushrooms made me see that everything is ridiculous, which really lessened the anxiety. And I've had stuff like acupuncture and osteopathy, but neither of those have ever really helped me and my boyfriend kiss Harry, so... And the day after that party, I did the most wonderful poos. They just slid out of me. Like these soft, elegant canoes. It was like there'd been 15 years of anxiety and then something said, "We can leave now." And I think it was in that moment that it occurred to me, I don't do the poo. The most I do is allow the poo. I thought, this is so important, I can't wait to tell the people. This medicine dissolved everything. It meant that I could just be in a moment with another human being without pretending to be someone better. I didn't need to feel special because I felt connected, because we are. I am you. I am you. And the only problem I have in my life now is not being on MDMA. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good night.